Hello and welcome to this GCP short, produced in partnership with Zurich Insurance and recorded on the final day of the European Captive Forum in Luxembourg in November. I sat down with Emma Sansom, Group Head of Captives at Zurich, and Francesco Capraro, Reinsurance Captive Operations Manager for Saipem's Switzerland domiciled captive Sigurd Ruck. Emma, Francesco and I spend 30 minutes reflecting on some of the themes emerging from ECF this year, including a discussion on fronting and reinsurance structures, parametric products, cyber, and what needs to be done to secure the next generation of talent for the captive industry. During the conversation, I do make reference to a previous GCP short on cyber featuring Zurich and their client Solvay. I've put a link to the episode in the show notes. There is also links to Captive Intelligence and our twice weekly newsletter and Zurich's Friend of the Podcast page on the website. So Francesco, welcome onto the Global Captive Podcast for the first time. I know you've been an avid listener, I think, of GCP almost from the beginning. So can you tell us a bit about your role and your background in captives?
Hi Richard, it's very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting to you and Emma. My background is I've been 15 years with the captive reinsurance company of Saipem SPA. The name of the captive is Sigurd Ruck. Again, we're based in Zurich. We provide reinsurance protection through fronting arrangements for pretty much everything that needs to be covered for the core business and the going concern of the parent company. So we started property and casualty, then we integrated in 2010 employee benefits. Now we do also financial lines from D&O to cyber. The core business of Saipem is a main contractor for the energy sector. It was traditionally involved in drilling onshore, offshore, and construction offshore, onshore. Now, through the energy transition, we are supporting clients also with different technologies, from solar power plants to offshore wind farms to carbon capturing and sustainable infrastructure. So we are transitioning with the energy transition, let's say.
Fantastic. Yeah, lots of big insurance challenges there on those topics. Emma, good to have you back on the pod as ever. You were presenting yesterday on fronting and reinsurance at European Captive Forum. Can you tell us a bit about that session, just kind of high level, and some of the topical trends concerning fronting companies such as yourselves at the moment?
Yeah, it's good to be back, Richard. Thank you for having me. So I think I just actually wanted to start off by sort of making a wider comment about the conference itself. It's really heartening to see so many people coming to talk about some very important topics, and I think the attendance has been really good. There's been a really good buzz in the centre over the past couple of days. So the session, I was part of a panel and we were discussing fronting and reinsurance. I think it is clear that there is a lot of opportunity in this space. I think there's some challenges around how the insurance carriers are engaging with their customers around things like fronting fees and collateral. We need to be transparent and engaged and really help customers understand what our pricing is, how we're assessing risk. And I think it's an ongoing engagement piece. I think that is obviously incredibly important to customers to make sure that they are making the right choices around which carriers they go with. But also I think it's really good to see that, you know, the fronting piece is I think growing in importance. Mm. We're seeing a lot of customers looking to effectively completely restructure their programs, and I've been approached by many of our customers on this topic. So when we talk about fronting, we're talking about a whole suite of services. It's not just policy issuance, it's not just premiums, it's not just any one thing. It's a whole ecosystem of services, and I think that's important. And I think those ancillary services are becoming more important, especially around resilience as well. So when we look at captive fronting, we have to look at the whole package. And as I said, you know, we've got a number of customers that are looking to restructure their programs completely. That reinsurance piece is becoming more around consolidating risks across the portfolio, and I think that's a really interesting development. And we've seen actually on the agenda at the conference over the past couple of days a number of panel sessions on cross-class, multi-year, multi-line and an ART. So I think when you bring all those things into the mix, it's the evolution of fronting and reinsurance, you know, it's really interesting to see. But I think that engagement piece is critical, because when you're restructuring programs, you know, you have to take all these factors into account.
Yeah, on that kind of restructuring and on that ART, structured reinsurance part you just mentioned, we were just talking to a broker a second ago in the hall. You know, they're a broker who are relatively new to the kind of captive reinsurance game, and they're seeing great traction. And I know there's several others who are really making strides. There's a lot more demand for those kind of solutions. Talking about kind of alternative solutions, I mean, Francesco, you were also speaking yesterday on lessons learned on captive programs and what can go wrong. You know, it's not always plain sailing. So what were some of the maybe specific examples that you and your panelists were highlighting in that session?
Yeah, absolutely. I like to highlight the fact that we changed slightly in the process the title of the session, because it was just what can go wrong. But we wanted also to highlight how can things be done right, which is the second part. So the panel was amongst me, another captive owner representative, a broker, and a fronting seeding company or direct insurer, according to where you want to see the insurance chain from. The idea was to give concrete examples as much as possible, try to really get into the operational things, so it was less theory and more practice, if you want. We structured the panel in four major points to develop. The first was about how to renew programs or kick off new global fronting programs with seeding companies. The other part focused more on claims handling, uncertainty in claim reserves, IBNR, difference in timing of reporting from different seeding companies, how you can somehow blend all the periodic reporting of seeding companies into the operations of the captive. So the idea is that if you receive all the quarterly reports at the 20th of every month, possibly you're not able to process them, so you're out with that. So really very operational things. Then we touched about forex exchange exposure, withholding taxes, too high of local insurance commissions, difference between master allocation, local allocation, and all the technicalities that go around those considerations and decisions, because then there is a regulatory framework, so not every country is the same, and so forth. Then we touched on collateral. So collateral, and that was very interesting, because you see the direct insurer perspective, the captive owner's perspective, and that is really a point in which you have to find a way in between. That was nice to have that conversation. So it was a general discussion, and honestly, I have to say thank you also to the panelists, because it was very interactive. The audience was great. We had questions, they were really participating. Then it was always 5 minutes longer than lunch break. Nobody stood up, so I think it's cool.
At the start of the conversation, we were talking about kind of alternative solutions and reinsurance, and parametrics is another hot topic. We've produced some content on this recently, and it's been prominent on this week's agenda as well. Francesco, are parametric solutions of interest to you, and do you think captives can use them?
Yeah, Richard, parametric is absolutely of interest, not for me, but for also my colleagues that are more on the core business aspect of what we do. I took the chance, honestly, after a few meetings we had recently during the third quarter, to have some takeaways from those meetings. So we operate in the energy sector, and parametric solution originates from climate resilience. So this idea that you put a trigger on a climate, or a double trigger on a climate event, and you have insurance protection. As main contractor for the energy industry, we try to negotiate in the contracts with the clients some, of course, is always there, the clause, it's called force majeure. The client is able to call the force majeure on extreme events and is, let's say, relieved of many of the contractual obligations towards the client. The point for us is that climate extreme events are becoming more frequent, and that's a fact. Plus, the definition of force majeure is according to jurisdiction, but you can say that it has to be an event unforeseeable and irresistible. So more frequency, a little bit less severity, is challenging to say that is irresistible. Then the key here is about the unforeseeability of the event. So new technology, you can predict better. So long story short, we are facing tough times to harder and harder times to declare force majeure in case it is needed. Therefore, parametric solutions can really, let's say, skip all these contractual wording, if you want, and get you directly to the capital where you need it and when you need it. And this is about the risk transfer part, I would say. Another point that we touched during the meetings is that through digital twins technologies, for example, the supply chain risk and visibility on the supply chain is increased. And so you also have an advantage with parametrics because it's very difficult to create a standard contractual wording to cover the supply chain because all the players in the supply chain have their own policy wordings, and it's very difficult to put all the pieces together. For parametri, you can also skip all that and having the capital again when you need it. So the timing is very important, but also where you need it, because you can see through the chain where you have the exposure. I would conclude my contribution to this, Richard, saying that nevertheless, it's not only a risk transfer that is important with parametri, but it gives you a lot of potential also for all the risk control measures and preventions, because the data that you can access through a parametric product through the captive to the parent and all the internal stakeholders is very valuable, because you can involve operations like procurement function, health and safety, and finance can also, let's say, be very interested, because it could be an alternative option to letter of credits, which is for us are very hard to obtain as a captive, because every time we need a collateral, we are taking away lines from bank lines from the core business. So this parametric, which is hybrid between bank and insurance, is very, very interesting for us.
Great. Thank you, Francesco. So, Emma, how do you see kind of parametrics and captives developing together over the, or either currently or over the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's opportunity there. I think it provides alternative coverage for these types of risks that Francesco was just describing. It's not without its challenges, though. And I think basis risk is one of those considerations that could potentially make or break the product. You have to design it in a way where the attachment point is where it needs to be, and that can be a challenging concern. So I think it's a good way of augmenting an existing structure. We've seen examples where in the market where customers have completely taken out certain massive perils and put them in a parametric product, and from what I've heard, that's working really well for them. I don't think it's going to be right for everyone, and it's not right for every risk, but there's loads of opportunity there. And actually, we've been talking to a number of customers about various initiatives around microinsurance, and I mean, it tends to kind of sit in the NatCat space quite often, but there's opportunities out there for many things, and we actually write a couple of products ourselves. So I think it's a way of providing additional capacity, and I think there's opportunity for customers to be looking at how they can utilize this in an innovative way. I think the challenge that we have sometimes is just monitoring the risk and the trigger points and making sure that you know, as Francesco alluded to, that if we need a double trigger in there to ensure that it remains an insurable product, then we have to craft that, and it needs to be a bespoke product that we work closely with our customers for. We tend to take a more collaborative approach with how we do it, so we're not necessarily out in the market saying that we write parametrics and this is our product. It's a bespoke product for each customer need.
I would like to add, because it was in my notes also, to touch another point on this. We were talking a lot about claims, but maybe it's a to looking forward thoughts that I have now, but we can, from my perspective, it can also be very useful for underwriting and pricing of the risk. I link it pretty much to the idea of a dynamic underwriting, which is something that is happening in retail insurance, so maybe we're far away from that. But for example, we are using just one rate for all the cargo transportation around the world. It's a flat rate. We're using one rate for buildings around the world. And through mapping digital twins, you can really see where you are in terms of exposures. And then you can simulate what happens if this happens or this other event happen. And this idea that you are able to allocate capacity in a much more efficient way through mapping of the risk from a, and being able to visualize that, that is something that as of today without parametric is not possible. Whereas if you start to implement a digital twin solution, you see this virtual reproduction of your risk profile, I would say. I think the idea is to put the capacity where you need it, when you need it, and according to the exposure you're facing. So I think you can have a premium, if you can create a premium allocation efficiency in that.
Yeah, it's interesting what you were saying as well earlier about, obviously, that if you're using the parametric to strip out perils from other policies, that's not only going to, the parametric's doing a good job for you, but it's also probably supporting your insurance buy on your other policies and maybe makes those negotiations a bit easier. So moving on to cyber now, again, another hot topic. There's been a lot of development in the cyber insurance market over the past 12 months. I think most notably the formation of the European cyber mutual Miris and new and interesting entrants, I think, into the commercial cyber market as well. But captive participation on cyber programs is definitely developing too. I seem to come across more and more captives writing cyber all the time now. Francesco, what do you have seen as kind of main opportunities and challenges concerning captives and cyber?
It would take, of course, a lot of time for me to put out everything I would like to talk about cyber. It's such an interesting topic. I have notes in front of me, but maybe I would just start from the fact that this morning I was able and happy to attend to this cyber breakfast that Zurich Insurance organized. And a lot of my points are just, let's say, washed away through the presentation. So maybe a little bit of a slight introduction about in the energy market, we were buying back energy cyber attack exclusion clause in the property wording. And then the cyber risk evolved. Back then, there was not such a thing of this high exposure to cyber. Then the years go by and you find yourself in the need to have a comprehensive coverage. So we are adapting what we purchase to increase the, let's say, exposure and the dynamic, also changing the exposure if you want. Nevertheless, opportunities and challenges are both in risk transfer and in risk control for us. For example, we were discussing during breakfast about ransomware events. For us, ransomware is still very hard to get protection for. We're still in a co-insurance situation, and where the captive can provide primary layer protection, buffer layers, we still do not have a lot of quota share in it because it is a kind of a very high severity situation. But I would say after attending breakfast, my takeaway, I had a note here saying that when we started taking the risk in, the pitch from brokers and fronting companies were, be aware, this cyber market is still a reactive market. We don't know that much, see what's going on. This morning at breakfast, my takeaway is that fronting companies, for example, Zurich Resilient Solution, they start to understand the risk and they're also able to quantify. And this is an advantage. To link to parametric, the main challenge, in my opinion, is that what happens if you go light in the wording because you're using parametric solution and then the system that tracks the trigger gets hacked. In that case, I think you have a clash situation, which you have a cyber, the parametric doesn't work anymore. So the more and more we go digital, the more and more we're exposed. But at the same time, we want to use parametric products and digital twins and all these new technologies that are the ones that are exposed the most to these threats.
Sounds like I missed out on a great breakfast, but
I'm slightly biased, but it was a great breakfast.
We produced a really good episode earlier this year, actually, with your Zurich colleagues Andreas and your client Solvay on cyber specifically. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes for those who have missed it. It's one of our most listened to episodes this year. Really fascinating how Solvay approach that, including their CISO in the process. How have you seen the conversation on cyber develop over the past 12 months? Because I think a few years ago we've done a few presentations together on it, but it feels like it's people are really embracing it now, and captures are really ready to kind of take that step.
Yeah, and I think in the past we probably talked a little bit more around sort of how to retain the risk and how to structure a program, but I think the conversation really now is more focused on the resilience aspect, so prevention as the key priority. And I actually sat in the session yesterday morning on cyber with Giselle van Toornout, who's the cyber and risk coordinator for MIRIS. And it was a really interesting conversation because she made the point that actually it's about dialogue and sharing information and experience that really drives forward this understanding of the risk. And to Francesco's point around quantification, so if you can bring the CISO into the conversation around insurance by being able to quantify that risk, so the conversation with the C-suite becomes easier. If you can tell someone this is your risk in monetary terms, then it actually it turns people's minds towards the actual impact of a potential exposure. So I think that is really where the conversation's going. I think that it's around having that engagement, and it's around making sure that the risks are understood so that resilience can be built into the solution. Once you've got an idea of the amount at risk, you've mitigated that, then that's when you can start to craft solutions. And actually, you know, the captive can sit at the centre of that proposition around building resilience. So I think the conversation around captive participation has evolved just from being around how can you retain the risk. It's around how can you provide resilience, understanding and engagement around that risk so that then you can craft the programme.
Yeah, exactly. And building resilience and understanding the risk is you can see it. There is the need to have also this know-how sharing, because there was a question during breakfast: how much time does it take for an organization to discover they've been hacked? Like 2 days, 24 hours. The most risk takers will say 10 days, and the average is 267 days, and that is impressive. And that gives you the key to understand how important it is to start to build up knowledge about it and start to build resilience so that you can make, as they said, uninsurable risks insurable, and you can create a business line eventually.
Just going back to what I was saying earlier about the CISO conversation, I mean, we don't have all the answers. We don't know what's going to happen. The risk that it is today is different to what it was yesterday, and it's different to what it will be in the future. So by sharing information, engaging with other organisations, you know, we can really drive understanding through and help to anticipate and understand how we can react or proactively prevent attacks and any sort of cyber challenges.
So just to finish off then, let's talk about talent, because I think this is a huge issue. It's kind of come up a little bit on the agenda, but there hasn't been, I don't think there's been a lot of it on the agenda this week. The three of us, I wouldn't say that we're young, but I think it's fair to say we're probably at the younger end of the spectrum when looking at the captive and commercial market and the people that work in it. Francesco, what do you think kind of needs to be done to attract more young professionals to the captive market, and why is it important that we do that?
First of all, Richard, thank you for reminding me the reason why I'm here at the podcast, because I'm getting older. Absolutely, is vital for the industry. I wanted just to read this. Captive insurance was coined by Frederick Rice, a property protection engineer in Youngstown, Ohio, in 1955. The first captive was in 1962 in Bermuda. So we are definitely at the beginning of having to say what? To say that we are not experts in going through this turnover cycle in terms of brings to the industry, because we just faced a few generational cycles through history, so it is a must to promote the industry, and I see two ways of doing it. First, advocate the industry at the, with the educational institutions, so high schools or colleges in the US, you have banks, insurance, but I don't think the captive industry is there. So this is the first channel, is through advocacy of the industry. The second is also to develop professional designation. So when you have attract the talent, you have to keep them in the industry. And I could spend, really hours talking about how excited I am in the industry. I am passionate about the industry. It's a great place to be. You are in direct contact with top management and big insurance players. You are very close to strategic decisions within the parent company, and that has an invaluable because you don't not only grow as a professional, but there is also the human factor that kicks in my opinion. When I had the chance to study a little bit, when I started as an assistant, I had the chance to go through the US route, so the ARM and the ACI, so an associate in risk management designation and an associate in captive insurance back then, because I was eager to find some background for what I was doing, and the US was far ahead of Europe. Now, Europe also is offering professional designations in risk management, which is great. What we are still missing in town is an associate of captive insurance equivalent. And I read yesterday the press release you did that there are movements in Asia. And I was having conversations in the room that possibly a European-centered captive designation would be super beneficial, because it creates also a momentum for putting a lot of pieces of the puzzle together. So the regulator that would like to understand better, at the same time would like to know that in the domicile you have professionals that understand. So it could be, a way to coordinate an effort, a collective effort to not only promote the industry, but also to put a lot of understanding about what we do, I think is necessary.
Yeah, I think that's all really important. I think there needs to be a European version of the ACI, which they have in the US. I know that Mitch from IC in the US just does the ACI. He's here. He comes every 2 years to Luxembourg. And we should give a shout out to Guernsey as well, because Guernsey, I think, have made a lot of progress in this area. They've got their international insurance management qualification now, or course. And that's, I think, gaining some momentum. I think AIRMIC are going to actually be hosting exams for that in March at the AIRMIC Captive Forum as well. So there's some real momentum going there. Emma, we've had a couple of, we've done a few episodes of Zurich in the past about this topic, and a few of your younger colleagues at Zurich on the podcast. Are you looking at initiatives at Zurich to raise the profile of captives and, I guess, commercial insurance more broadly with young professionals?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head with the educational piece. I mean, it's something that has been lacking, I think, for some time now, and there's a clear demand for it. I mean, it's a very technical topic to wrap your arms around, so I think there's a clear need for that. I think it's something that collectively we need to, as an industry, respond to. The idea of going into educational institutions, I absolutely 100% agree with. I think as an industry, generally the insurance industry is not as well known or a top choice as a career. And it always surprises me, because it is such an exciting industry to be in. And I think the narrative that I hear quite often is that people fall into the industry. I myself did that, and we have to change that narrative. I think that it should be something that people are aware of, and that they can see that there's opportunity for them across a broad different spectrum of disciplines. So when we think about insurance, we think about brokers, we think about underwriters, actuaries, but actually there's a whole host of other disciplines that help support that whole piece. So there is work to be done, and I guess it's up to us to be doing that, to promoting it. I'm not sure I'm quite ready to go on some of the social media platforms that perhaps the younger generation are using to do that.
But should captive GCP be starting a captive team TikTok account. Is that what you're saying? I'm happy to take that pressure on.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, look, if, you know, the way that the younger generation is communicating is very different to the sort of the older generation. So we have to bridge that gap, and we have to find engaging ways of promoting the industry. Don't have all the answers, but certainly it's something that we need to come together to understand and move forward.
Well, that's been a really, really enjoyed that conversation, guys, towards the end of European Captive Forum. It's been great to hang out with you both this week. So Emma and Francesco, thanks for coming on to the Global Captive Podcast.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.